Well, I suppose my career in space sciences started when I was a callow youth of 16 in the United Kingdom. Having got my school certificate, I joined the Meteorologic Office as a scientific assistant and was posted to London Airport, where the big new planes were coming in at that time. That first year was spent in taking weather observations and plotting weather maps for the forecasters. Fortunately, I had a good pair of legs on me, as well as lungs, and I was a prominent runner in those days, and running for the Meteorologic Office in inter-departmental events, and I was able to get a posting of my choice near a home to the RAF station, radar station near Rye, where the Meteorologic Office had a small research branch, small, very small. There were only three of us, the chief scientist, assistant and myself, and our job was working on cloud and fog research. That being a very clean area of England, the fogs were pure, and the physics of fog formation could be studied a lot easier. My job consisted of sort of climbing these 350-foot towers and maintaining the instruments on the various decks at 50-foot intervals and replacing the slides and doing counts on fog drops. And I suppose my tracking career started then, because that was when we were launching balloons into that lower atmosphere, just visually tracking them with theodolite, assuming their rise rate was at a fixed rate, and measuring their azimuth and elevation as they sort of drifted up at stopwatch intervals, getting a azimuth and elevation angle position so that we could correlate all this data. I suppose that was the time that I sort of started avidly reading science fiction. Being a scientist in those days, early 50s, was still a fairly romantic thing. It's sort of lost its glamour these days. Omnipotence of scientists is not so apparent now as it appeared to be then. Continuing my career, I suppose, I can't recall exactly why we moved on. I think it's probably just growing up. A couple of years later, when I was nearing 19, I was transferred to the Royal Aircraft Establishment in Farnborough, where the Meteorologic Office also had a research establishment at a slightly different aspects to it. I'd moved from sort of fog near ground environments then to cloud, sort of a bit higher up in the atmosphere. At Farnborough, we did radio theodolite work, that is, sending off balloons with radio transmitters and doing a bit of tracking on those, and not only tracking but actually getting back temperature, humidity, that sort of data. So again, my job was there sort of repairing and maintaining that sort of equipment, and also flying in aeroplanes. We went out looking for thunderstorms. Most planes try and avoid them. We went out looking for them. We used to fly underneath the clouds, through the bottom of the clouds, through the middle of the cloud, through the top of the thunderheads there, very rough rides those were, and across through the top. Even went as far as North Africa to find these sorts of thunderstorms. Taking observations, taking droplet counts and all those sorts of things. I guess the next stage, while I was still at Farnborough, by then I'd met my wife-to-be, Joan, and had started courting, and I guess when the next transfer came up, I was reluctant to go. So I transferred across to the guided weapons branch, the Royal Aircraft Establishment. which was a little bit out of Farnborough, just two or three miles at a place called Bramshot on Bramshot Common, about a weapons branch. That, I suppose, is where I really became an engineer, because I started studies at the Royal Farnborough Technical College in electronics, applied physics, and that was, I suppose, a real foundation of my career as a telemetry engineer, which is I still at heart am, even though I'm now teaching. Bramshot, we were visiting Salisbury Plain, launching rockets there and monitoring, and my career there was effectively to design and actually design and make telemetry modules which observe different parameters of the performance of these of various rockets. I was involved in the Blue Streak program at in its development. As you will probably be aware, that had many, many delays before it actually reached Australia and they started the launch program. Before that had happened, I was beginning to, I was getting a little bogged down, and as still a civil servant in those days, promotional progress wasn't as fast as I thought it ought to be. And that was one reason where I felt a change was warranted, and also I was beginning to have twinges of conscience about working with nuclear warheads in rockets, etc. So it was an appropriate time to consider an alternative career, and I left the Guided Weapons Department and the Ministry of Defence, or Supply, Ministry of Supply it was called in those days, and departed for private industry around about, what was that, 1960 I suppose, and joined Mullard Equipment Limited, which is a subsidiary of Philips, still working on telemetry and instrumentation. My position there was in the nucleotic instrumentation branch, where I was a project leader of a small group designing monitoring equipment for nuclear establishments, power generation, and also for using nuclear materials for testing materials and other things like that, which was a very fascinating job, and I really enjoyed that. But again, I guess around about 1963 or 1962 or so, I started thinking about Australia and emigration, because I'm still a little unsettled as to being a boy from the back blocks, the working class in a society which was not exactly classless. I felt that my opportunities for advancement were a bit limited, and we started casting our sights towards Australia, and I contacted several big companies in Australia, Philips and AWA, and I can't remember the third one now. And AWA were kind enough to interview me in the UK and offer me a position at their facilities in Sydney. And emigrating, where do we leave? England in early 63. And about 2 weeks before we actually departed for Australia, having made the decision two or three months before that to actually come, they rang me up with an offer of a position at Carnarvon in Western Australia. Not actually a position, because they hadn't got the contract at the time, but asked for permission to put my name on their tender for that particular contract, pointing out that my experience in guided weapons and telemetry was just what was required, and that it would be a very pleasant way of introduction to Australia. I guess I was a bit uncertain and conveyed my uncertainty at the time, because having made the break from that sort of career and into industrial instrumentation, I had an inkling to stay there, and we weren't sure that we particularly wanted to go right out in the desert bush. So we left that as a possibility. I agreed to let them put my name forward, but didn't actually commit myself to going there if they got the contract. Things hotted up a little bit. There was a possibility of we went by ship on the Canberra from England to Sydney. There was a possibility even at that stage, just before we set off, that they're going to fly me off to Australia and Joan to follow on the boat, which she wouldn't have liked at all. And also even a telegram we got on the sea asking me to be prepared to come ashore at Colombo and fly the rest of the way to Perth for an interview and rejoin Joan in Sydney. But that never materialised. I guess contract negotiations in those days were a bit as slow as they are these days. So we continued sailing to Sydney. It was in Sydney that I was interviewed by Lewis Wainwright. IWA presumably had got the contract at the time, and Lewis, who was the first cessation director at Carnarvon, interviewed me. We didn't exactly hit it off, Lewis and I. I wasn't certain that I wanted to go there because, you know, I sort of had thought I'd left that part of my life behind me. And he wanted committed people, and so quite naturally turned me down, as I found out from him and AWA a little while later, only a few months later. That fact had not gone as well, and it didn't surprise me because I wasn't very enthusiastic at all. Anyway, AWA convinced him to give me a trial, so they flew me over to Perth, and I had a week at Mushe, which was, I suppose, in the ends of its Mercury program at the time. So I had a week travelling up to the Mushe station, and I suppose the magic of space tracking re-engaged my attention, and the prospects didn't seem so bad. I got quite interested in it. I guess I got caught up in the enthusiasm of the work they've been doing with tracking men in orbit. And we both, Lewis was station director at Mushe at that time, and I changed our minds. And so I became a part of the Carnarvon team. It was still a little early. We were only just getting the team together at that time. And having moved back to Sydney, I was involved in interviewing prospective staff at Five Dock for the station. Ultimately, a couple of weeks later, I was part of a four-man team that went to the United States for 3 months of training for the new station. The four of us was Monty Sala, who was an engineer, an AWA engineer in Carnarvon, and Peter Hedford and Arch Jury, who were engineers employed at the AWA facilities in Sydney. All three long-standing members in AWA, and me, who was a new employee. They had to do all sorts of things to get me there, of course, because my British passport was confiscated, taken in before we moved to Australia, and we were travelling on a document of identity, and so my passport was in transit from the UK to Australia until I could legitimately have it back. So AWA had to front up at the passport offices in the in Sydney, and with bond money, because I was leaving the country, and that's what new immigrants had to have, bonds like that. And we went down to Wynwood Station, I think, at one of these telephone booths, and had my passport photographs taken. And 2 hours later, 2 hours after application and payment of bond, I had an Australian passport. And travelled with the group to the USA.
other way.
That was the first of my three training trips to the United States in my 11 and a half years at Carnarvon. Had I known at the time that I was going to spend that long in Carnarvon, I guess I might have had second thoughts. But the plan, I guess, was really 3 years contract, be a nice financial leg up, and a return to Sydney and continue to work in the factory would settle us down into Australian life nicely, with a nest egg to help us supplement the money we'd brought from the UK to buy ourselves a house there. But as time unfolded, Carnarvon entrapped us, and we stayed there a long, long time. It was a very special place, and I'll endeavour to give you some reason why it was so professionally satisfying, and I guess and the other half, it had to be quite satisfying for the family, as from a family point of view, otherwise, because you can't stay in a place like that without your family behind you as well. Having, I won't go into the details of the training in the States, because I don't think it's particularly relevant at the moment. Spent some time at Wallops Island, which was the a small military tracking facility on the border of Maryland and Florida, I'm not quite sure now, but on the border of Maryland and the state just to the close south of it, wouldn't be Florida, and then the other half of the time at down in Sarasota in Florida, where the EMR, who made the telemetry equipment for that tracking station, were stationed. Having returned to Australia, and spending a few weeks at Five Dock, we and having bought our furniture and other sorts of things, we travelled over to Perth and waited there until advice had been received that all our stuff was in Carnarvon waiting for us. And in the 2 or 3 weeks we were in Perth, I travelled daily out to Mushe with two or three other fellows that were also destined to go to Carnarvon, and a sort of I can't recall what we exactly did when we were at Mushe, but I guess it kept us occupied and it was some sort of training, although what was happening there, Mushe was relatively low key, but some of the people that were at Mushe were going to join us at Carnarvon, so it would have served a very useful purpose of helping to bond us into a team and getting us used to our new station director, Lewis Wainwright, and he presumably used to us. So we eventually arrived in Carnarvon to start on the installation of equipment there. Joan will no doubt fill in all the details of the domestic problems of moving to a place like that. My concern is mainly with engineering. I was one of the telemetry engineers, nominally a senior engineer for want of a definition. The engineer in charge of telemetry and acquisition aid was Bill Kempes, a very good friend and a very good engineer. And for the first 3 years of my time at Carnarvon, I was sort of 2.5 years, I suppose, of that time. That was my role, working with the pulse code modulation telemetry, and with a group of people that were working around. I wouldn't say it was the easiest of times, because we was all, I suppose, a little bit prima donnas. We all come from different parts of the world. We all had our professional integrity to preserve. And I guess some of us were a little touchy about, particularly those that probably came from the UK, who were a little bit more class conscious, perhaps, and the Australians are a little bit more irreverent about those sorts of things. And so tempers were a bit prickly at the time. I guess they were never absolutely smooth, but they were shakedown years. The first year was very much a shakedown year, and there would have been a few people that would have said, I've had enough of this, I can't stick this for 3 years, including myself. Let's investigate possibility of going back to Sydney. But we did settle down, and we became a great team. As I try and express later on, Carnarvon was a particularly unique place, particularly after that first 3 years, because of the variety of equipment and the variety of tasks that were being performed there. We had an extremely big staff. We were the biggest station outside of the USA mainland. I don't think there would be many in there that would have matched us for the variety of things that were happening. And like other Australian stations, I would suggest that the quality of staff generally was higher than it was on tracking stations in the USA. Our engineers were fully professional. We had a number of them. A place like Carnarvon, of the latest moving into the manned space program, the temptation for Australian engineers to participate in that was very great, so that we were able to recruit and did recruit some very highly qualified people that these days now are in a very senior engineering positions. So it was a hotbed of technical involvement, the forefront of technical equipment, with some highly qualified staff working and running on them. So it was a very invigorating environment to work in. Pause. Oh, Carnarvon, CROW was its code name, CRO as it turned out to be. Carnarvon was no paradise. It was very nice. I guess our wives thought we were going up to an air-conditioned paradise, but in those very early days it certainly wasn't that. And we were perched there up on the end of Browns Range, and Browns Range is not a very imposing piece of geological structure at all. I think it was only around about 50 metres high at the highest point where we were at our end. But it had the distinct advantage from a tracking point of view being in a radio quiet area, being 600 miles away from the nearest city and 300 miles away from the nearest town, Geraldton. I talk about miles because our early days in Carnarvon were miles rather than kilometres, and I think of miles when I go to Carnarvon and back again. But we were perched on this little sand ridge, old dunes I guess, right on the edge of the Indian Ocean, Shark Bay. And we had a negative horizon, which was quite distinct all around us. The antennas could come down below horizon level, so we could see to the horizon in all directions around us, and it was below us in every direction. So it was an ideal spot for tracking point of view, but it was on the edge of the desert and a very sandy, dusty, windy place. We suffered until we got some lawns and vegetation around the ridge there, excessive amounts of sand, plagues of stink beetles, different sorts of caterpillars. In those early days, of course, right in the bush there, until we thinned them out, I suppose, snakes were a problem too. I recall one story there. We still had these raised computer floors, and we were still installing them out of the stage when we were putting the equipment in. You sort of have little islands around where the equipment was standing on, and the rest of the floor was sort of not down yet because we were still cabling connecting up. And I was sitting at my desk as a senior engineer. I had a desk, and so I was sitting there organizing myself and preparing for the next stage of the installation and testing, and I heard this voice, fellow standing right next to me, shouting, "There's a snake down there." I think he was actually saying, "Paul, there's a snake down there." Paul being my name, you see. But I totally ignored him, because if he was standing right next to me and shouting, he must be shouting to somebody at the other end of the room, because snakes were not uncommon in the room there. He's come in the doors, and we had to really flush out the underfloor there to be absolutely certain it was safe for us to crawl under there, because there isn't much room to get out of the way when there's a snake around. And he shouted again, and he shouted again, and all of a sudden he stepped down and he put his relatively close to me and put his lips close to my ear. Shades of Merv Matthews in the future, but he was no tongue in it at all, and whispered to me, "Paul, there's a snake just down by your desk." And I jumped and leapt away, and there was a big brown snake, a dugite, right curled up just around the legs at the bottom of my desk. It was a bit somnolent because it was cooler inside. Still, we eventually got the equipment working, eventually got involved in the Gemini space program. My particular interest, I suppose, and my particular responsibility in the telemetry of those days, not only the equipment which was decoding everything that was coming down from the spacecraft, but also the biomedical equipment in the control room. And I suppose when we had our first manned space flight, first Gemini flight, not the first manned space flight, but our first Gemini flight, which is the first one we actually supported, that would have been on my one of the high points of my career. There are a number of them, and I'll I suppose it might be pertinent to mention those now, because that was one of them. I suppose if I look back, the points that stick out in my memory in space sciences that are personally involving for me was the first one, the really high point, the very first point in that was while I was at Mallard Equipment Limited, after I left at Guided Weapons, suddenly the loudspeakers in the factory floor, because we had the science branch and the development branch was sort of little partition things on the edge of a big production line factory, the speakers on the factory floor suddenly burst out with this beep, 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 and excited announcers talking about this first spacecraft that had been launched by the Russians, Sputnik 1 as it was. And I recall standing in the middle of the floor there in a sort of entrance listening to this. I guess I was so caught up in the magic of it. Eventually I was brought to back to ground level by my colleagues, who wondered why I was so entranced. That was a very high point in my perspectives of what I think was important in the space program. And I guess the next high point for me was that very first Gemini flight that came over Carnarvon in the control room, which was immediately adjacent to telemetry room, assisting the man on the biomedical console with the readouts and of the medical signs, the breathing and the pulse, respiration and blood pressure and all those other things of the astronauts. Being a telemetry engineer, as I was, and sort of the excitement of actually almost a living, breathing man. You could hear him talking, and there was all his biophysical parameters being read out, and being responsible for that was a very magic moment for me. I guess the the very next point, and this is going ahead a few years in my time there, was when I was very privileged to be at Tidenbilla as a visitor, just looking at seeing what was happening. At the on the control room again, because I was a member of the space tracking team, so I was inside rather than outside, being present in the operations room there when the lunar lander, the first lunar lander, survived its first lunar night, and sort of standing there as it as the as Tidenbilla revived the lunar lander, and as the first picture of the lunar surface. It wasn't the first picture, but it was the first one after surviving this fortnight of extremely cold temperatures at lunar night. And there was this scan going across the horizon, the lunar horizon, and pixel by pixel, this lunar vista was being revealed on the monitor in front of me. That point lives in my memory, will live in my memory as long as I've got a memory to think, as a very distinct high point in my life. I suppose the next big point in that was, moving on a few years, is when Neil Armstrong first put footsteps on the moon. Although Carnarvon was in a support role, Tittenbiller with the New Dish at that time was supporting the men on the moon. Our role at Carnarvon with the Unified S-Band there was to support the poor fellow that was left in orbit. But we were picking up signals from both of them, naturally. I was that time as the engineer of the Unified S-Band system, and I was standing behind the monitor that we had receiving these signals, and I make the tentative claim to be the first man on the surface of this Earth to see a TV picture of man stepping on the moon. Carnarvon, although it wasn't supporting the lunar lander, it was supporting the lunar orbiter, was marginally closer to the surface of the moon than Tittenbiller was, and microseconds or nanoseconds earlier than Tittenbiller we would have received the signal, and since I was standing closer to the monitor than anyone else, I claim to be that man. Apart from that tenuous claim on fame, it was an utterly magic moment, the moment when for a man like myself, who was particularly enamoured of science fiction, being a scientist involved in telemetry, and thinking of being able to support somebody on the surface of that, man's first exodus from Earth, I found that quite magic. I mean, there were earlier moments when Apollo 8, which was the first lunar orbit, the loop around at Christmas, I can't remember which year it was, those were magic moments, but the high point was that landing on the moon. There have been other points since then that have been quite magic, the planetary flybys, which are supported by the Deep Space Network, but of those four points I've mentioned, Sputnik and biotelemetry on the first Gemini flight that we supported, lunar lander revival, man on the moon. I don't ever feel the same again until man steps on the surface of Mars. Correction there, I've been talking about Tittenbiller as being the supporting station for Apollo. Of course it was Honeysuckle Creek. Although the antenna was, I believe, later removed to Tittenbiller. Tittenbiller was deep space. Honeysuckle Creek, which was adjacent, almost adjacent, was the manned space program. And then, of course, there was Auroral Valley just over the hills again, more in the other systems. Carnarvon, of course, combined almost all of those features. I suppose back to the main story. Here I am. Telemetry engineer in the telemetry section, and around about two and a half years after starting at Carnarvon and finally settled down, and the announcement of the manned space flight program, a man on the moon before the end of the decade, and the decision to install a unified S-band system at Carnarvon, was when things changed for me, because Bill Kempis, who was the supervising engineer of telemetry, was appointed to be the supervising engineer of the Unified S-Band, and I succeeded him as the supervising engineer of telemetry, because telemetry would still have its role to play in as the adjunct to the antenna and receiving things of the Unified S-band. But Bill drew the line of renewing his contract for a further 3 years and to go to for training in the USA for the Unified S-band program, and a last-minute swap was done between Bill and myself. He returned to his role as the supervising engineer of telemetry, and I became the supervising engineer of the Unified S-band team, and departed for the USA for another 3 months with a small group of, I think there were again four of us. Monty Sala, my colleague from the previous trip, joined me again. He became the digital engineer for the beginning or a continuation of a great career for him in engineering, and a couple of others, John Fletcher and Ben Ryan, I think it was, two senior technicians, joined us. We went out to Texas, to Dallas, for training there for that program. I think overall that the early Apollo years were probably the best at the tracking station. Not that the rest weren't great, but by that time, 3 years, the team had got to know each other. There would have been, I suppose, a quarter or a third of them departed at the end of their contract. There was an expansion in the crew because we not only had to continue maintaining the Gemini crew, but recruit for the new systems for the manned spaceflight. So my team, the Unified S-band team, consisted of a solid kernel of experienced trackers from the Gemini area, from the other systems, arrange rate, telemetry, Q6, and communications. And when the four of us returned from our training, others had arrived from recruiting from the UK and within Australia. I think the odd New Zealander, and I think we even had an American as well, which was, although we saw many of them, we would have only had about two or three on the staff over the 10 years we were there, actually recruited. So coming back was a case of knitting the team together, the training there, building and installing the equipment and testing it out. And there was a little bit of a delay in the Apollo program. There's always delays in programs. So we would have had a little time to twiddle our thumbs, so to speak, from an operational point of view. So there were the need to keep the team occupied and the further training and maintenance skills and using some of the team to help train the new people in the other areas. So it was a great time for knitting people together. I know while, for example, the Gemini program was going on between Gemini GT-11 and GT-12, there was GT-11 and a half, which, for example, was actually built and or part-built, finished, I should say, was a better word, because our maintenance staff would have had a lot of the building. GT-11 and a half was Gina, I think it was, the rocket that sort of maneuvered the capsule and the manned capsule, were built and manned by the Unified S-band crew. There would have been four of us in the Gina vehicle, which was long cylindrical one, which would was a little bit lighter. And although the Gemini vehicle only intended to carry two astronauts, there were six of us to carry it. We had to have six. Originally, we intended to have four, but it was too heavy for four of us, so there were six of us. And if you can imagine the Gemini vehicle and the Agena vehicle doing docking maneuvers in this in the Carnarvon Tropical Festival up and down the main street. These two huge look-alike spacecraft with just a set of legs underneath, eight legs under one and 12 legs under the other, sort of going up and down the main street doing little pirouettes and docking regularly. You can imagine that it was quite a sight. Of course, won the prize for the best float and was the predecessor for other events of a similar nature. So that was, you know, quite, those sorts of events were helped to bond the team together. I had a particularly fine team. I recall that some of the technical problems we had initially were solved in rather unusual ways. The unified S-band antenna was an XY mount for the non-technical. We're all pretty familiar with the azimuth elevation mount antennas, or ourselves, for example. We tend to, if we want to look at something, we tend to rotate in the azimuth horizontal plane until we get to the point, and then tilt our head up or down to a particular elevation. So we tend to be, people that tend to be an azimuth elevation mount. And all of our antennas on the tracking station have been that at the time, and they're easy to visualise and easy to conceptualise, and if you want to point the antenna in the roughly the right position, you can sort of easily visualise what those angles are, and not hard to measure them from an azimuth elevation point of view. But the unified S-band, its dormant position was effectively pointing directly upwards, the zenith. Its XY mount, the X would have been the rotation to the east-west, and the Y rotation was after the X had rotated, the Y would have rotated on it. So it's not strictly north-south, it was north-south with respect to the current position of the east-west axis. Not dissimilar to the deep space mounts, which are slightly tilted because of the Earth's plane. So they were quite similar to that, but not quite the same. So we had problems, for example, in the early days, before the computers were installed. We had an up and operating unified S-band system, no computers to drive them from a tracking point of view, and the deep space program was going. There was vehicles on the surface, landers on the surface of the moon, broadcasting in the right band. We could have, we did, our intention was sort of use those. So no computers. We had two problems. One, calibrating the optical systems, which could be done on an Earth basis from a tower, but were not precise enough because they were not distant enough. And the other one was getting the antenna to point to the moon. You think, well, that's not very hard. Adjust an antenna, point it towards the moon. The moon's a big enough object up in the sky. You could just point it there. But our beam width was only 1 degree, and the TV antenna optical system only gave us a 1 degree aperture, 1 degree diameter aperture. And if you could imagine what we got, 360 rotation, 180 over the top, 360 by 180, we're talking about 400,000 sort of holes in the sky, which you've got to try and find the moon. And it's not, it's not particularly easy to rotate yourself. I mean, you can rotate yourself, find the moon, oh, there it is, it's about 60 degrees up, and it's around about 45 degrees from north. Let's point in that direction and do a bit of a scan, a raster scan, until we find it. But XY antennas don't have the same sort of degree things like that, and I wish I'd kept it. I suspect Ben Ryan still has it with fond affection. The first time we found it successfully, Ben Ryan, who was the antenna technician, came to the USA with us for that training, was an ex in the Royal Navy, chief petty officer, technical technician type, and his naval training came to the fore. A little pocket compass he always carried with him, I don't know why, went out lined up a matchbox, because he was a smoker, on a low brick wall there, on a north-south, one plane on a north-south plane, and then did a sort of a sighting, like draw a line on it, then did another rotation and drew another line, brought it in, and with a school protractor that somebody had for drawing exercises, measured the angles off, and we rotated the antenna to those two particular angles, and did a little scan, and we found it quite quickly. Very novel solution for him, but it led to us producing a sort of an astrolabe. I still have it at home, designed by Ben, made up by our maintenance staff and the power station. Consists of a long, it's all painted black, of course, a long black tube, a little eye socket on one end to rest the eye comfortably, so designed so that the hole at the end gave us a 1 degree aperture, possibly only around about 1.5 degrees aperture, slightly larger. It was a sort of improvised design and adjusted to the length to be suitable, so that when you sighted along it and got it in the right angle, the moon just filled the hole at the end. This was mounted on an XY mount to sort of U-shaped things with bearing pins at the end, and then that took the other Y mount in there, and with little pointers running against these little plastic protractors which every kid has in their senior school pencil case. The protractors had to be replaced a couple of times when they got cracked, but they're still standard size. And what you do, we had little two holes on the bottom, and there was a peg outside the USB room, in which is a post with two pins on it, which were precisely aligned north-south. You just trotted out there, put the device on it, sighted down the tube, read off the two angles, came back in, and it was accurate to a half a degree. So we overcome the problem of being able to find the moon before we had computers, so that we could actually start doing receiving signals and tracking like that. Well, that was the radio alignment, if you like, or the radio training, so that we were actually usefully occupied. The other part in the early days was the calibration of the optical systems, alignment to various things to make sure that the angles were read correctly, the optical system compared to the mechanical axes of the antenna. Again, we were sans computer, and I had just acquired these new Hewlett-Packard calculators. In those days, a Hewlett-Packard calculator had 10 memories on it. Scientific calculator came in a hard folded case with a plush velvet lining, you know, and they cost the earth. I seem to remember paying £300 or £400 for this calculator, which you can buy now for or the equivalent for a few dollars, less than 10 probably. And this was quite a valuable tool, and I had always been a little bit of a mathematician, I suppose. I had to taught myself all about complexities of solar or stellar mechanics, navigation tables, with the help of my ex-naval people, to understand what the tables meant in the first place, and to build the procedures for converting the solar and stellar coordinates into XY coordinates, so that we could position our antenna. So what we would do is calculate the position of prominent stars, depending on what day and what year and what month it was, and position the antenna on that point a few minutes before, 10, 15 minutes before the star is, and then take recordings as the star came across the axis, do the necessary alignments. So we were doing it in the early days mechanically, getting it all lined up on the basis of these calculations. When the computer records eventually arrived, we had we were within a whisker of being accurate, so we had actually saved a lot of time in the alignment procedures. and learnt also a lot about things of that time. In the meantime, the rest of the station was settling down very nicely. I recall we'd moved to a new, because of the complex, the Apollo room was up the other end of the building. The control room was also moved into that area, and we had a new control team, more shifts and things like that, and we had two controllers, I suppose, for the two different shifts. Deputy Station Director Paul Oates was one of the controllers, and my bridge partner of long standing, and the other was senior operation engineer Dick Simons, who was the other PCM engineer with me in the early days of Gemini. I moved to Unified S-Band, he moved into operations. Well, both of them were a little bit of a, and that was a good point. I mean, they were excellent operations engineers. They really kept the station ticking along nicely. They were stickler for necessities and preciseness and response. And we would have had lots and lots of practices at different times. But both of them were Englishmen, POMs, like myself. Both of them tended to be a little bit rigid, I suppose, and with the traditional irreverence of Australians to authority, there were times when the team out there on the network got a little bit irritated by the what they presumed to be the pomposity and preciseness of these two people in the control room. Dick was a very formal Englishman, I suppose. Went on to become the operations manager, I suppose, of Aurora Valley when he moved on to there. I don't remember the exact title. Did a fine job there, but I know I can recall one incident to give you an idea of the sorts of things that went on. Mind you, all these things disappeared when it came to the critical points when we were doing the real thing, teams operating. We had, I suppose, the best communication systems in the world, not Carnarvon, but the space network. We talk about high-quality telephones these days. We had them then. Our intercom system was absolutely precise. We had a very formal language for communication on intercoms because we would be speaking, we would have speaking on one and maybe monitoring three or four others, and all of these different nets would be doing different functions, but having half an ear open to what's happening in the other ones because of the need to coordinate, and you'd be switching from one net to another depending on what stage of the operation you are. So it required a cool head and required a lot of discipline on how one used one language and how one communicated. No room for fooling around. Nevertheless, there were times when things got a little bit bundy, and there was the incidence of the Phantom Fuffa, and it was quite common. I mean, traditional when you the normal sort of thing. Once you linked onto a network, you wanted to be sure that your link was active, and you'd do a little to sort of just to make sure that you were connected. But this Phantom Fuffa got up the wick of both Paul and Dick, because at any times when there was any, I suppose the participants thought were unnecessary pomposity from the control room, or perhaps a little bit too sharp to justify it, the Phantom Fuffa would start going at all the times, you know, immediately after any particular pronouncement. And I suspect it was only one person. I've got a good idea who it was, and I'm not going to say so here, but it could have been a number of people at different times. I was I suppose I had stuffing knocked out of me quite early by the Australians. I was, suppose, a little bit of a pompous pom when I first arrived. it was a place where you gave as good as you got, or you went mad, and some did, and then moved on. Others survived it and didn't change, but didn't get on, in a sense. I think I survived. I had dozens of nicknames given to me by the staff. I was known as the Hairy Orange. I think that was a phase when my first American trip, I came back with a crew cut, and I had, in those days, bright red hair. It's only white these days. And I was tending to wear, I had a few orange knit shirts and things like that, so I was called the Hairy Orange. And my cartoon traditionally was a sort of a round-shaped head with a few spikes coming out of the top to indicate my hair, and horn-rimmed spectacles, which I had in those days. So quite distinctive and a good likeness. I was also nicknamed, and that stuck with me for the rest of the time at Carnarvon, the beginning of the Unified S-Band days. After we came back and started installing the antenna, Ben Ryan, who was the most irreverent of our Australian members of the staff, ex-Navy, taught us all the tricks of Navy mess rooms and bar songs and bar actions and all those sorts of things. I used to, of course, be out there with my hat and a big sort of toweling thing around to keep the shade off of my neck and ears and things. I was very easily burnt, very conscious of the sun, and I was called El Khalib, which is, I believe, Arabic for the leader, and because of my sort of Arab appearance in my attire at the time, and that stuck me all the time. My youngest child, or my middle child, the first one that was born in Carnarvon, was known as Mini Khalib, and all sorts of little irrelevant rhymes came up at different times. I recall when I returned from that first trip, it would have been my second training trip to the USA. I came back to a control room which was installed at that time, and there was a big poster on the wall as I came in near my near the area which was to be my supervisor's desk, and there was this big colour photograph of the moon, which I still have, I think, somewhere, and it had some little horn-rimmed spectacles that had been cut out of cardboard and correctly coloured and stuck on the moon there, and a few little orange bits of cardboard had been sort of stuck around the top to make it sort of look like the cartoon of the Hairy Orange, and underneath I think it had something like "We're next?" question mark, sort of irreverent comment on my climb through the ranks to fame, and which had been manifested in various ways, and the my tendency to always to look for something to do and do to assume responsibility for it. I had a bit of reputation already, I think, at that time. Little things like that kept the place sort of livened up and moving on. Well, I won't say too much about those Apollo days. I mentioned the actual landing. Apollo 8 was important for us. Apollo 13 was critical. The survival of those astronauts of a ruined thing, and of course the landings and so on, and our other things, other various actions. I think it's probably appropriate to mention, you see, the station was growing as the shifts grew and other activities were installed. I mentioned before that Carnarvon was I think we were sure of it at the time, was the biggest station outside of the United States, ideally located because of launch patterns and position around the Earth. I think even from a deep space point of view, it's probably better located for spacing around the Earth than Tidumbilor itself is. But I won't venture into that argument. It was lost 20-odd years ago. But We had a number of antennas there. It was the FPQ-6 radar, which was the closest to Hill, which is a precision tracking radar, C-band. We have on the telemetry and control building, or Hill as you call it, we had the telemetry. There were two acquisition arcades, as they were called, antennas for early access as the manned space came over the horizon for sort of near space communications. There was also the UHF command antenna, which was uplinking commands to the spacecraft at that that stage for the Gemini. There was the Verlor radar at that point the Verlor radar. I can't remember what we tracked with the Verlor radar. It was on a little concrete tower out the back there. And of course in that main building we would have the Unified S-band antenna installed. And for a short time there, below the Unified S-band, just below, down on the hill, pointing towards the south, we would have had a large wire net antenna, which was part of our radio communications to the USA before they installed the OTC station on the other end of the Brown Range. Then on the towards the ocean, where there was the range and range rate site, where there were a couple of antennas there for supporting what you might call Earth orbit cislunar tracking equipment, antennas that were spacecraft that were moving between the space between the Earth and the Moon, more for geosynchronous satellites that were investigating atmospheric, upper atmospheric conditions or near Earth conditions, magnetic fields, all the sort of scientific little things that were going around. And down in the hill between range and range rate, the TNC mountain or hill as we were on, there was the SPAN station, the Solar Particle Alert Network, maintained by a couple of people from the CSIO and a number of our own technicians to support them, who were part of that early warning system on solar flares, studying solar flares and presumably giving warnings about appropriate times for launching astronauts on lunar missions. And as I was going back to say, there was a Solar Particle Alert Network, SPAN, down in the valley between Range and Range Rate and the TNC, and in the middle days of the tracking station, I can't recall the correct year, a laser station was built there and established. The intention of the actuality was to send lasers to the surface of the Moon, where tri-corner laser reflectors have been positioned by astronauts and other spacecraft. So it was a sort of to measure precisely the position of the Moon and the Moon's Earth orbit from those laser actions. So we had a very, very complex station. There was a lot going on. There was always something going on. There were a huge number of staff. I think we peaked at over 200 in our maximum days in the Apollo and ancillary things. So there was always something going on and always something happening. For example, our FPQ-6 radar people, the precision radar, got involved in some rather novel projects. There was the research with the CSIRO on the territorial habits of wedge-tail eagles. There were a number of them around, and of course we had the all the salt pans all around us. We had, an unlimited horizon, and there would have been a number of territorial areas so that the CSIRO people would go out there, capture their wedge-tail eagles, bait and capture them, and put on a little metallic collar, a little aluminium foil sort of thing around their neck, which didn't inhibit their flying or other things like that. It was non-invasive. There was no radio transmitter, and the FPQ6 radar would spend virtually the whole day, the moment the first eagle launched himself in the morning. You could usually get a visual sighting on them, or you knew where they were. They would latch onto them and would be tracking this bird through the day as it went through its various maneuvers, visited various corners of its territory, sort of went up in a thermal on salt lakes and down again. So they were able to precisely map, because of the precision radar, precisely map the position of this eagle at all times of the day with respect to the landscape below it. That went on for quite a few months. Another incident, we would another variation. There were some very large balloons. Well, they became large because when they get up into the very upper atmosphere, balloons tend to expand. Right up in just about as on the top of the atmosphere, as high as balloons can go, which were in orbit around the Earth, in the sense that they were not in orbit in free orbit, but they were sailing around the upper Earth's atmosphere, and would have done two or three orbits of the Earth before they eventually collapsed and were no longer viable. These huge metallic balloons, which were formed good targets, and of course they were handed on from station to station after they'd been tracked, and they would be in view of ourselves for quite a few days before they'd passed out of view. So there was lots of little scientific things of that sort, passive sort of space activities, as well as all the others. Now, I had mentioned before that we had a very high quality staff, a lot of professional staff, probably a higher level than, certainly a higher level than common through the manned space and deep space network in other countries, simply because we were manned by Australians and Englishmen, professionals within the country, whereas the stations in America and other places tend to be manned by para-professionals. Good men. I mean, we worked with a lot of them, met them, and they were absolutely excellent. But they, very few of them. I mean, the proportion of them that were professionally qualified, were professional engineers in the sense that we would talk of them, were quite small. And so we had the quality of staff that could make things happen if we chose to make it do. And there were times for things like that. I recall we eventually, a matter of organisation, the station grew in size and the needs of the station train changed. There were arrangements to reorganise it into two big groups. I eventually, about a couple of years after the start of the Apollo program, became the tracking supervisor, and my responsibility extended to FPQ6, the precision radar, the range and range rate, and unified S-band. That was my particular group. The rest of the station was the rest of the other facilities, the computers, the telemetry, and the SILAS particle network, and the commands was the other communications supervisor, I suppose, for want of a better title. And that worked. I think it resulted as a part of the fact of a number of us that have been there a long time and always looking for something to do, myself included, in the ways that we started to use the station. I guess it rose out of the improvisations of the early USB. We're always conscious that there were lots of satellites up there, operating all sorts of radars and all sorts of frequency bands, and that our various antennas had a range of features, and because we were all there on the same site and we were all aware of each other, it was quite often possible for us to interact with these other spacecraft in a passive way and get value out of the exercise of working with it. It meant, of course, that we were quite often, because we were not all on identical spots. We're on different parts, they sprawled over different parts of the Browns range, that we often had to write little programs to transfer the tracking position so that we could acquire these other spacecraft. But it led to, for us, for example, experimenting with the transfer of time between, say, range and range rate and unified S-band. We were, in fact, able to calibrate our stations against each other using transfer techniques through these, in a passive way, as I stressed, between these other spacecraft. And as a sort of result of that, and that position, that ability to make sure that the station was all on time. When we talk on time, we're not talking down to the second, we're talking down to the millisecond or microsecond time in between. You can imagine the more precise that the tracking is of a tracking system like Unified S-Band or FPQ6, if you've got their geographic position down to thousands of a degree and their time clock vis-a-vis to each other is down to microseconds between them, the accuracy of the tracking data you can get, the triangulation you can get from several co-located stations gives you a much more precise result. And I think we were able to achieve quite an increase in our performance as a result of that. And because of our initial experiments in transferring time and via satellites performance we're able to give, we ultimately actually connected the stations together with coaxial cables for the purposes of being able to transfer time to things like that and to, you might say, bring down to earth our technique, and because of its value, less effort was necessary to maintain that performance. And again, as a result of the various efforts of the people there just to enjoy themselves in between times and use it for training and other things, a couple of times we were able to offer, I think, the Range and Range Rate Network, offer them performance from the rest of the station at times when the spacecraft were having difficulties or other stations would have difficulties, which our station was not designed to provide because of our efforts and our experiments and our play at other times, we were able to offer them, and had it accepted, actual scheduled operational support to do things that they could not have achieved otherwise. Another incidence of that sort of creation, if you like, of facilities, Unified S-Band, because supporting tracking at lunar ranges, precision became a lot more critical. You were trying to maintain meter accuracy for docking maneuvers at lunar range. You do need a great deal of precision. And we're also supporting the early parts of the deep space network launches when those interplanetary missions were not covered by three stations. You needed some in-between ones, so we would have provided support there, and tracking was precise as well. As a result, we had rubidium. I think they've got to slightly different chemical these days, but rubidium clocks on site to maintain that very precise time interval. The second is exactly a second, and not marginally longer or marginally less. And we would have had regular flights. We used to fly around the Earth regularly with rubidium clocks on board, visiting the stations in turn to calibrate and make sure that our stations are on time and to make sure that our absolute time, right down to the year, day, month, day, second, millisecond, microsecond, was precisely the same as everyone else on the network. In between times of this calibration, we did the best we could. We would monitor VLF stations. Our local one was Northwest Cape, which was only 150 miles north of us, but there were others in Hawaii and South Africa and other places like that. And we established at Carbon, we, pedantic I suppose, my team's timing engineer, Hamish Lindsay I think it was, used to do it for us. We kept very elaborate and careful records of the phase difference between the various stations, you know, Northwest Cape on one frequency, Hawaii here and other ones. You could only get them at different times of the day because of the nature of the atmospheric conditions. But once you got them, you could lock onto them and you could determine the phase difference between ourselves and them, our rubidium clock, if you like, and their frequency between the different stations. And by keeping precise records of each station over a global network, you were able to take out the variation, the diurnal variation of a station and the seasonal variations. You know, these would drift throughout the year. And so you might say your, I'll just toss a figure in the hat, you might say your 35 milliseconds different from Hawaii, and tomorrow you're 36, and the next day you may be 37. But of course you don't know this exactly 37, because it may be units of 200. It might be 237 or 437 or 637. But because you're looking at several stations, many stations, you can do sort of a triangulation. And if you miss, if you lose your time, as we did on occasions, it happened, you could get back close but you never get back precisely. If you lost your time through some sort of incident, you could get back sort of on time by locking onto one of these others and sort of guessing and various things. But if you've triangulated on four or five different stations and you can pick, because of the your records, your relative time to them, you say, well, I'm 237 or 437 or 630 on this station, and I'm 332, 432, whatever on that station. With enough data like that, you can actually pick exactly which phase you are, and you could bring yourself down to two or three units different to what you were before. And we re-established our time a couple of times that way. And to the astonishment of our visiting rubidium clock people, when they came in, we were on schedule, you know, well within accepted tolerance. Consequently, their cost dropped because they decided they didn't need to visit us so often. And can't say that our technique was applied elsewhere, because it did require you know, careful monitoring. I speak of these things because these are the result of the you know, very highly competent sort of research-oriented staff who were busy trying to find things to do and to fill up the time. They weren't content just waiting for the next mission. They were always looking for ways to enhance the performance of the station and do things with it. Well, things went on. After a couple of years as the supervising engineer of the tracking group, our chief engineer moved on elsewhere, and I was appointed to be the chief engineer of the Carnarvon tracking station, which was a great honour. I was very honoured, but also was a bad experience for me, because I talked about highly professional staff. Of all the engineers on the station, supervising engineers, senior engineers, etc., I was the only one that technically was not an engineer, technically I say. My qualifications, I was a professional physicist, professional scientist if you like. My degree was in applied science. My major was in telemetry, remote sensing and remote measurement, so I was well, a better of an expression, if you like, an electronics engineer, but I did not have engineering qualifications. I had science qualifications. And I know when I was appointed chief engineer, it did cause a little bit of disquiet amongst the other engineers, some of the other engineers, I must be right. Most of them had no compunction at all. There were a small group of them that felt a little bit disenchanted. They've been happy to work with me and for me in lower roles, but to be a non-engineer, to be appointed the chief engineer, was a bit more than some of them could stomach. There was only one of them that actually felt that he needed to resign over the result, and got a transfer back to AWA in Sydney. The rest of us settled down and back to our original good tempo. I had a good year and a half as the chief engineer, and then was appointed the company's senior representative on the site because of movements there, and that would be the last 4 years of my 11 and a half years in Carnarvon. And I suppose, I mean, that was a new phase of my career, involving myself in the niceties of catering. We had problems with the caterers at that time, and I had to, I really got into the nitty-gritty of talking to catering institutes in Perth, catering managing systems, and started my management studies through external studies at Curtin as a result of that. Got involved in finance and started training there in the management, which stood me in good stead when I eventually left the trucking industry. Unions and awards and things like that. I guess it was a time when Carnarvon was getting to, at the time when I was company senior representative, Carnarvon actually reached its peak in staffing. It also was a time when the Americans, I guess, were getting somewhere towards the end of their program, and the euphoria of man landing on the moon was evaporating a little bit, and the costs of that exercise were beginning to be brought home to the American taxpayer, and there was considerable pressure on the tracking stations to operate more economically. So I not only presided over the growth of Carnarvon's tracking station to its largest staff, but I also presided over the screwing back the economies, saving money here and there, reorganising the way we operated the station, always, of course, under the supervision and the pressure of the station manager at that time, who was the ministry station manager at that time, was Ray Jacob. My job was to satisfy them, of course, and earn the company as big a bonus as I could. So I got into the niceties of working with unions and awards. Union action became more avid then. There were strikes. We had them at Carnarvon, not as quite as bad as they were in Canberra. More work to rule than anything else. And building up to the Space Tracking Industry Award. And then my arguments then were to try and maintain a way in which we could operate a sliding shift system because of the nature of our Earth orbit support. Clusters of orbits didn't come around precisely the same time each day. They sort of came around every day about an hour earlier than they did the day before. So your shifts were always constantly moving forward to cope with this, which made that our award perhaps a little more complex than the other. But there were still good times. I mean, having been brought up with the most of the people in the staff, I was one of them, and not necessarily an outsider brought in. I understood their needs, they understood my background and knew that I knew what the problems were. And so we maintained a good relationship all that time. I recall that my hairy orange image survived. I was still there, still part of the what was happening. During the union negotiations, I've still got all the clippings, I think, on in my scrapbook somewhere. It appeared on the nearly every morning on the station notice board, a new cartoon about that time. I mean, I was still El Khalib. So I was still El Khalib, but in a sense, I was elevated in these cartoons. Those of you know the cartoon strip, The Wizard of Id, the little king there, and various other characters in his domain. These were ideal fodder for management, union, management, peasant king-peasant relationships, of course, and these regularly appeared nearly every day, particularly the more frenetic the union arrangements were, the more frequently they appeared, with the head of the king altered to become the hairy orange head, myself with the horn rimmed spectacles and the spiky hair with a little bit of a crown there on one side, and the wording altered to suit the situation. They were always good humoured, very sharp and pithy and addressed the point, but they were good humour and it, our relationships were maintained that way. Now, we'd had early, right in the very early days of Carnarvon, used operators in the range and range rate in particular, and particularly successful. I noticed there, I was looking the other day at the reunion and some photographs of the early range and range rate team with all these young ladies who were the operators, mostly locally recruited, almost totally locally recruited, in a uniform they'd chosen for themselves, and it was back in the miniskirt days, a very short uniform. It had started then. We'd recruited young ladies that had left school with leaving certificates, I suppose. There wasn't much capacity for their working life in Carnarvon unless they left and went to the city. And Carnarvon tracking station did offer that possibility. There was all the secretarial position, support position, library and operators. And we had a number of operators came in there and went on to bigger and better things as a result of their training there. At the time of the economies, you might say, and we had to start looking at how we were going to run the station more economically, we went to an increase in the number of operators when staff were leaving and moving on. Instead of recruiting technicians, a lot of our technicians that we had there and engineers had been there for some time, were very experienced people, and we could effectively run the station a bit differently, and we recruited both locally and of course nationally. We were recruiting operators in quite a lot in Perth and some from other parts, and we increased the proportion, I can't remember what percentage, of the number of operators in the staff, which are less highly paid, and worked our shifts probably on smaller numbers than we had before. I guess we knew the equipment better, knew what was likely. We could always call out an expert to maintain it, so that our maintenance team, if you like, our expert team, became more essentially day-oriented shift workers, day workers, occasionally on shifts in the off-shift, off-operational period to do the maintenance work. Call out if necessary during peak periods. We would have had a nucleus of technical people there, but not as many, and supported the station on fewer people and operators who were highly trained to do the job, and it worked very successfully. We pegged back the cost of the Carnarvon a great deal, and I think it was very sad in the end when it was felt that of course, all the people in Carnarvon thought, West Australians thought it was perhaps more political than technical. It was nice to have the tracking station network centred, deep space, and the extended man space at Honeysuckle centred on Canberra, the national capital, rather than dispersed around Australia. We, of course, thought it would... And the site was ideal, which it was. There were less problems of radio interference, which there was. And we weren't having any recruiting problems, which we didn't. People moved into the town, lived in the town and became part of the town. And some of the people, many of the people, I'd say, at the Carnarvon tracking station, stayed in the town at the end of the demise of the tracking station. I would have stayed there, or we would have stayed there, if there had been some way of... I could find some employment that suited me. When it came to leave Carnarvon, company wanted me to transfer back to Sydney. I'm afraid my various trips over there, recruiting and other things, each time I came back, greatly relieved how much quieter Perth was than Sydney, or Melbourne even, and how much quieter even Carnarvon was than Perth. And we'd been there, 11 and a half years, and our two eldest children, 5 and 3, were now 15 and bordering on going to university, and they made it quite clear that they weren't leaving Western Australia. They were going on to university in Western Australia, where all their friends, they considered themselves Western Australian, and effectively we were as well. So when Carnarvon Trucking Station closed down, we stayed in Western Australia, and I took up my second career as a teacher of computing, as I am at the moment. Even after I'd been here a year, I had received offers to manage one of the stations deep in the miserable deserts north of Alice Springs. And a year after I left Carnarvon, I received an offer to become the chief engineer at Tidmonbilla. Of course, I regret in some respects not taking those options up, because space had got in my blood. It's still in my blood. I still maintain an avid interest in it. But some of the cream has gone off a bit. I know we get these nice little magic things, and we are still talking about the Man in Mars program. I think by the time they get Man in Mars, I'll certainly be retired and wouldn't have had any part in it other than as a spectator. And I've enjoyed being a spectator. But I can never forget the partition I had in that man's greatest adventure, I think. It was unique. We have adventurers before, and the adventuring party have survived some horrendous situations, and I'm talking about man's early exploration of Earth and other things. But the team that was put together, the team we had, superb. The team that the manned space flight had put together, and I guess the deep space flight still has, around the world, the relationships that we had with those people at other stations. There are still people around the world that I know by sound, their voice, that I communicate with occasionally or hear of. I ask about who I've never met. I've seen pictures I've met, and the moment they speak again, I would know them, because our relationships were quite intimate over the network professionally, and we chatted at other times. Some of them we still communicate with, Christmas cards and other things, and we have invitations to visit the world, and I'd like to have the money to be able to accept them sometime. We saw many people come through there. I've centred this history on what happened at the Carnarvon Trucking Station, my perspective of that. There would be many things I've left out, little stories. I'm not one to remember many of those, but I... too rabid on. I keep going on here. I was saying it was a good life in Carnarvon. 11 and a quarter years, I think. I participated extensively. I guess we all did. Professionals, even our supervising engineers, senior engineers, or any of our technicians, supervising technicians, their average income, despite shift work, would have been higher than most people in town. We were the passing through people like bank officers and police officers and teachers and trackers, as we were called, were the passing through people, and they formed a sort of a ginger to the town that kept activities going. Things like the tennis club, of course, was performed, a lot of local people in that, but things like the discussion club, sort of ladies and wives and things meeting together. The dramatic society, I know wife Joan was a regular pianist of those, and the concert nights, the dinner concert nights. I played lead roles in several productions there, and I know other people, Peggy Olgate, Len Olgate's wife, who was the FQ6 engineer and the chief engineer later on after I moved on. She was a prominent member of the Dramatic Society. Dick Simons produced plays and was a prominent actor there. So we got involved in many, many things around. Stop again. I had members of Apex and Lions, Rotary. I was a Rotarian myself for a number of years until I got disgusted with their general disposition to celebrate and party rather than do things, so I resigned and never rejoined. I think people, after about 6 years, we reckon people stopped asking us when we were going to leave Carnarvon, because until then they had been thinking after 3 years they went, and after 6 years they figured that if we hadn't gone after a second contract we weren't going, so they stopped asking. And after I was at Carnarvon for seven, getting on for 8 years, I was invited to become a Justice of the Peace, which was quite an honour. I think I definitely was the only one from the Trekking Station invited, and I would have been the youngest justice in the town. I guess it was because of my management role, company senior representative of the Trekking Station, and the ability to find some time to do court work, mostly on Saturday mornings. Two of us would meet and deal with the local population that had run foul of the law, mainly for drinking and disorderly defences. The magistrate only visited about 1 week in four, and the other 3 weeks were handled by justices. I was a member of the committee for foundation of the high score, doing the statistics for the survey and presenting as a delegation a report and a request to the minister down in Perth. We flew down in Dawson Tuckey's plane, who flew us down and did that. I was invited when Danny Norton, who was the Labour member of the Legislative Assembly, retired, invited to stand for pre-selection as a Labour candidate for that seat. Joan wasn't very keen, and so and I wasn't sure that I was myself at the time, although I was a very political animal, decided not to, possibly just as well, because the Liberal candidate got in. Perhaps if I had accepted, maybe I'd have got in and I'd have still been around. So people participated very greatly. I think one of the reasons why the Trekking Station was so successful is because it was part of the town. Although it was a part in the sense that they were not townies, they were a different sort of employment occupation and possibly a little higher paid than most of the people. Our houses were in the town and built around the town and separated from other places apart from the very first group. And our wives and children grew up with the other town's people, and we participated heavily in activities around the town. A lot of our people were prominent members of the sailing clubs, building boats. A couple of them sort of initiated the trimarans in that area, big sailing boats for sort of ocean sailing rather than just ordinary sailing. There were a lot of very keen fishermen amongst the group, particularly Max Garth, one of my colleagues in the Unified S Band, who pioneered the art of fly fishing with the small game up and down the coast there, and even has a rock up near Quabba named after him, Garth's Rock. And it was because of Max that the Carnarvon Trekking Station won the annual NASA Game Fishing Contest on three occasions in a row. All the stations all over the world in fishing areas competed in the Games Fishing Contest, and the fighting fish, and the point scoring was based on the weight of the fish and of course the strength of the tackle that was being used. If you've got a large fish with a very light tackle, you score more points than getting a small fish with a very heavy tackle. Because of our strategy, or Max's strategy, Carnarvon was extremely successful. There's a lot of game fish off the coast there, from Carnarvon upwards, Spanish mackerel, tuna. Although they're not very big, we went out fishing with very light tackle, and we went hands down, even against all these people in the big game fishing areas of the Bahamas and Jamaica and Florida and places like this that have the really big game fish. We didn't see many big ones, but we caught lots of very sporty fish, and so won that. When I think of it, that Unified S-Band crew that I took over in the fourth year of Carnarvon, they all went on. Three of the members of the group formed a very successful little dance band around the town.
can remember the names. I had to come back to that. A couple of them married local girls, different ones. One still in Carnarvon, a very successful plantation manager with his wife. Another one married a local girl and now is a telecom technician on Geraldton. One of my engineers, Brian... Ooh, yeah, I should write down these names beforehand. Who built his trimaran. He actually took over from me when I ultimately left Carnarvon for the last 3 or 4 months, actually dismantling the station and disposing it. He stayed on in Carnarvon, was the engineer, helped install the Radio Australia in the remnants of the tracking station, and ran a small boat constructing business there for a while until things took a downturn. Another one of my technicians in the USB, Frank Vinton, had a part-time marine radio service and maintenance and marketing business in town with all the prawn boats and operating from there. Extremely successful, relocated to Geraldton a few years later, where he's, I understand, not just extremely successful, but extremely, extremely very successful. So that crew was particularly supportive of town life, and as a result of that, I think we did well. I know initially when we first arrived, there were only two small groups of houses built on the very fringe of the town. Very fringe, we're only talking about half a kilometre out of the centre of the town, on either side of the cemetery on recovered ground, sort of next to the Fascine area. And very clearly, a small group of houses on one side were bigger than the group on the other side. And naturally, the manager and the senior engineers were living on one side of the cemetery, and the junior engineers and technicians were on the other side of the cemetery. And one of the very first questions the townies, the people in town, would ask us is, which side of the cemetery do you live? Joan always had a good answer for that. She said, on the outside. So they were very conscious. Carnarvon, despite we come from England, to avoid the class situation, people in town, I think, were very conscious of our rank in the station to start with. But I'm quite sure that evaporated after a couple of years and was never a factor thereafter, because we were all rich as far as they're concerned, one and all, because of the ship duty and higher wages, technicians, etc. But people in the station did give a lot back to the town, and in return, consequently, we got a lot from the town, very good support from the town people. And I know they are still very sad to have seen us gone. And many of us go back, many of us stayed, many of us go back regularly, and we're always very welcome, very much part of that at that time. A very special place. By contrast, I can talk about the OTC station, which was built in the middle of our time there to provide support for communications for Carnarvon, but later on, of course, to provide support for Earth orbiting geostationary satellites for communications for other purposes. They were built on the other end of the Browns Range, about 4 or 5 kilometres out of town, at the junction of the Gascoigne Junction Road and the highway, where it does a little dogleg before it goes further north. And all the houses for that were built out there. And the people although we had friends, we were friendly with the people in the OTC because of our joint responsibility. They were never really part of the town and participating as fully in town life as the Carnarvon tracking station people, because of their the fact they were out of town, and so they didn't get quite so drawn into things. I suppose there's one little incident that ought to rank very highly on my high points of my life with space, as you might put it, was that we were... Because of the sugar scoop that had been installed there to help provide communications to the tracking station, one of the very first geostationary stations that was launched to provide communications between the UK and Australia failed to go into a stationary orbit and was drifting around. But it was still active for a while, and Carnarvon, because of its location, took part in the very first live transmission of television between Australia and the UK and vice versa, because of our facilities there. As part of that action was to bring people from into close to London to the studio in London, and people in Carnarvon who had relatives there, mostly tracking station people, one other couple who were town people, but Poms, who had relatives near and about London. And it had to be, we were interviewed for that, and we were placed on the possible list of interviewees, but in the end, because our relatives were some 50 miles out of London and couldn't get there at extremely short notice, we didn't reach the final interviewing panel, but we were advised by the producer exactly where to stand, where they'd be holding their things, and so we took up position in the town because the Australian end was done in the broad sunlight, and western scene of a West Australian city looked like a Western movie, actually, the street scene in the centre of Carnarvon. TV cameras set up there and crowds of people in this celebration near the War Memorial. And we all, we were stood up there, and for the whole of that broadcast where these people would be interviewing, there were the denches sort of the next rank back behind the people being interviewed. So we had very excited phone calls from all our relatives in England who'd have been seeing it, and later in that year was rebroadcast in the UK as one of the highlights of the year, and certainly it was one of our highlights at the time in Carnarvon, participating in the first live broadcast from UK to Australia and back. So ends the story of Paul Dench and his space tracking days since 1975, when I left the space tracking industry to remain in Western Australia with my family, a decision, as I said, that I've only occasionally regretted, to become a teacher, to do a diploma of education, become a teacher in the West Australian system. I've had a very interesting second career as a teacher, lots of interesting positions at different times, and have kept, of course, in contact with my old colleagues and with interest in what's happening in the space tracking industry. For those that listen to this tape, I haven't mentioned you. I'm sorry, my memory dims if I have mentioned you. I hope it was with affection and not with spite, and good luck to all of you.